I'm here today to present three recommendations about collateral consequences. And just by way of history, collateral consequences was one of the original topics that the Reentry Task Force was created to address. So the task force formed the Collateral Consequences Working Group in June of 2016 and very broadly tasked that group with kind of evaluating how Colorado is treating the collateral and the other consequences of involvement in the justice system. Members of the group include myself, Aaron Kreitz, Jessica Jones, Jack Regenbogen, Melissa Roberts, and our new addition, Scott Turner. Now, just as a quick review, anytime somebody's involved in the justice system, there are direct, collateral, and other consequences of that involvement. The direct consequences are what's imposed by the judge at the end of the case. Things like jail or prison time, probation, fines, all the stuff that's going to appear on a minimus or a sentencing order issued at the end of the case. And with rare exception, those are all things that come to an end one day. But the law also imposes what are known as collateral consequences of conviction, which are defined as either mandatory sanctions or discretionary disqualifications. A sanction is a penalty that applies automatically as a result of a conviction, whereas a disqualification is a discretionary penalty that a government actor can but is not required to impose on an individual as a result of a conviction. Now, these mandatory sanctions and discretionary qualifications can impact many areas of people's lives that are regulated by the government, including employment, public benefits, the ability to be a part of one's family, immigration concerns, and other civil rights and privileges. And collateral consequences, unlike the direct consequences, do not necessarily ever come to an end one day. When I talk about other consequences, those are the things that private citizens have the power to impose on one another. Things like denying employment or housing on the basis of a criminal history, and the very real social stigma that comes with having a conviction. But the collateral and other consequences of the conviction matter on both an individual level and in terms of the broader public welfare. On an individual level, representatives from all branches of the system, from social scientists to attorneys to law professors, have recognized that if folks can't make an honest living in a safe house, then they're more likely to commit future offenses. And at the same time, they're less likely to be able to pay restitution or other financial obligations stemming from the offense. And there's also been a recognition that, you know, restitution and recidivism concerns aside, second chances are important, and people should have the opportunity to work beyond this day. And more broadly, the sheer number of people that can be subject to employment and housing-related penalties as a result of a conviction presents a community welfare issue. Over 190,000 people were arrested in Colorado in 2015, and approximately 1 in 3 adults of working age has some form of criminal record. And the reduction of employment rates caused by a criminal record when applied to such a broad number of people has an impact on the health of the economy as a whole. And it's well documented that the employment-related consequences of a conviction disparately impact communities and neighborhoods of color. So it's critical that the restrictions that we as a state place on people because of a criminal record be both fair to individuals and productive to the broader community welfare. The working group started this process by trying to identify how collateral consequences are most critically impacting the reentry and reintegration prospects of people with conviction. And what we found was that, unsurprisingly, employment and housing are the two biggest concerns. After completing that identification, we set out to develop a set of principles to guide our own efforts to achieve meaningful reform. And what we agreed on was this, that involvement in the justice system should not result in collateral consequences that needlessly undermine individuals' future success, counterproductive to the safety or welfare of society, or exacerbate racial inequalities, that public policy should reflect emerging research indicating the predictive value of an offense declines over time, and that the public's access to criminal history information must be better balanced with individuals' right to privacy and the safety and welfare of society. With those principles in mind, the working group has been developing recommendations to improve how Colorado treats collateral and other consequences of involvement with the justice system. At this point, we have three recommendations that have been approved by the task force and I'm going to present to you in detail today. And as I go through these, if anybody has any questions or comments at any time, I encourage you to talk to them. So our first recommendation is about orders of collaterality. Collaterally judges are currently able to enter an order in a criminal case, relieving an individual of most collateral consequences if that person is being sentenced to either probation, community corrections, or some other alternative sentence. So for example, if somebody's an electrician and they think that a conviction is going to put their state-issued license to practice their trade at risk, they can request that the sentencing judge issue an order prohibiting the applicable licensing board from revoking that license. So this mechanism should be a valuable tool to allow society to punish crime, but at the same time allow people who have a conviction to remain productive citizens and do things like pay restitution. But unfortunately, the current statutes governing orders of collateral relief have some shortfalls that limit their effectiveness. Most critically, the orders of collateral relief are only available at the time of sentencing. So they can be a great tool for somebody who's about to enter a sentence in the community, but they can't have any impact on somebody who's trying to become a more productive citizen long after a conviction is entered and a sentence has been completed. So this recommendation would allow people to request an order of collateral relief at any time after sentencing. We would also tweak the definition of conviction just for purposes of that statute so that somebody can request an order of collateral relief after a successfully completed deferred judgment and sentence, because even a successful DJS can have some significant long-term collateral consequences. And it would establish an equivalent mechanism within the Children's Code to allow for orders of collateral relief following a juvenile adjudication. Finally, it includes a non-statutory recommendation that the judiciary develop a better mechanism to track when orders of collateral relief are both requested and granted. The current statutes have certain exclusions from eligibility. There are some types of convictions for which an order of collateral relief cannot be granted, and there are some types of collateral consequences to which an order of collateral relief cannot apply. And this wouldn't change any of that. The eligibility criteria, the exclusions, the standard of granting relief would all remain the same. So really the biggest impact of this is just expanding the time frame in which an order of collateral relief is available. Does anyone have any questions about that first recommendation? Okay. The second recommendation is about private employment. Unlike several other states, Colorado currently places no restrictions on a private employer's ability to refuse to hire or to terminate somebody based on a criminal history. Colorado law does prohibit employers from asking about sealed records, but there's currently no enforcement mechanism for that prohibition. So that means that somebody can either be fired or not be hired because of either a record of an arrest that never resulted in a conviction, or sealed or expunged records without facing any sort of penalty under Colorado law. Under federal law, on the other hand, private employment restrictions can give rise to liability under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 because they can have a disparate impact based on race or national origin. But this recommendation would simply give meaning to Colorado's current record sealing and expungement statutes and apply existing EEOC guidance. It would render it a discriminatory or unfair employment practice for an employer, employment agency, or labor organization to make any inquiry about or to act adversely to an individual on the basis of a record of any arrest or charge that did not result in a conviction and the criminal case is not actively pending, or any criminal justice record that has been sealed or expunged. Now, under all of those circumstances, either the individual hasn't been convicted of a crime, so the presumption of innocence still applies, or a judge has already found that the public should not have access to that particular information. The proposed statutory provision would be enforceable by Doris Civil Rights Division in the same way that it can currently enforce prohibitions on discrimination based on factors such as race or religion.
Clear, this is just for private money, this is not for agencies?
Correct. So this recommendation number two applies strictly to private employment, and then the third one that we'll get to in a second is state.
What about child care centers? Child care centers, when you have findings of abuse and neglect, they're not necessarily admissions. Same thing with adult protection, the new adult protection laws. If you work in an adult protection agency, if you work in an agency that serves at risk adults, you can have a finding, and you have a process where you can appeal it, but it's not necessarily a condition. And it might come to a little bit with the new laws around adult abuse if you're working in a population of at risk adults.
Okay.
All I'm asking is, does this compete on that, on the civil side for child welfare and adult protection?
And to the extent that, you know, abuse and neglect type orders can be used to deny employment, there was never any intention on the part of the working group to impact
that
at all. Right. And the one thing to recognize here, when you look at the language that's proposed, it's talking about not acting adversely on the basis of the record itself. So, you know, when you look at the EEOC guidance, if the employer is prospective employer, you know, sees the person commit a crime, it doesn't make any difference whether they've been arrested or not. Like, they can terminate the person on the basis of conduct. And that's exactly what we're trying to, you know, leave in place here. What we're trying to get away from, and what the EEOC already says that employers shouldn't be doing, is making decisions based on the arrest record alone. Because, you know, that's the arrest record in and of itself is not proof of wrongdoing. And obviously, it's not been in court to establish a crime of guilt. But to the extent that the court has already made a finding that there has been conduct, I don't think that this recommendation would touch on that in any way.
So,
you know, this would be a huge shift in civil rights actions. Particularly with investigation and enforcement through the Civil Rights Division. I think the reason why we've steered away from doing that is because we've created a pretty big fight in the legislature. But what about the whole issue of ban the box? That's the whole reason why that legislation was brought this year, was so that way the employer would still have the opportunity to talk to someone and just hang out on their employment application. We learned through the legislation I forgot what the huge percentage was of people get stopped right at the beginning because of the box. So why not go in that direction? What seems to be a better balance than actually asking the Civil Rights Division to do things?
Well, and this is simultaneously more narrow and more broad than the ban the box idea. I mean, the ban the box says you can ask any question you want, you just can't ask it until later. And this says there are one or two very specific questions that you're not supposed to ask at all. Now, you know, as to the sealed and expunged record, that's already in law that employers aren't supposed to ask about that. But there's no, when we relocated all of the record sealing statutes from one part to another, the enforcement mechanism that had been in place didn't relocate with them. So, and as to, you know, arrests that didn't result in conviction, I mean, that too is something that employers that are following EEOC guidance should already be doing. And, you know, we did talk to the Civil Rights Division about this. The, you know, all of the government agencies that we've talked to about these ideas have made very clear that they can't take a pro-con position on this, on any of the ideas. They can really only provide technical assistance. And the head of Doris Civil Rights Division did point out that, you know, under existing Colorado law, you can bring a disparate impact claim. But this isn't really what we're getting at. I mean, on some level, it's not just unfair to deny someone a job because of an arrest that never went anywhere, if they're black or white or this religion or that religion. It's unfair to do that to people generally. When you have nearly 200,000 Coloradans a year getting arrested, you know, we're not creating some sort of a protected class here what we're doing is making sure that we're all protected. And it, because it fits within that goal of achieving fair employment practices, it made sense to us to put that within the list of the stuff that Dora's Civil Rights Division is already enforcing.
Just to speak to, I think, where your other question was kind of going is that this is with regard to not just any criminal record, but records that did not result in any kind of criminal conviction. So being in the box, the ways when someone can pull that back on or ask questions about whatever criminal history you might have, whether or not it's a conviction or otherwise, this is specified and specific to arrests that don't lead to convictions or deferred judgments that have now dismissed and not on criminal records and should be held against you.
Yeah, so I'm all about this. As a civil rights attorney outside of my legislative stuff, I'm all about this, but I'm just looking at the political realities of trying to get something through both chambers. Because this just will not fly. I mean, I think you can agree with me.
Absolutely.
This will not fly. So is there some way to get a strike a happy medium where maybe we can incorporate a little bit of the two without involving the civil rights division within the box and not having to disclose a non-conviction that you were just charging with? Is there some way to go about doing it that way? Because I mean, this right here, this is so important, right? I mean, because as soon as you leave jail or whatever, this thing shouldn't be hanging over your head forever. You should be able to get employment, you should be able to get housing. People who don't, will go right back to their criminal behavior and back into the system. And this is like, you know, ground level, common sense kind of reforms that we need. But, you know, to get it through the legislature, we need to have something a little bit more balanced.
So Bandbox failed twice now, two sessions in the work group, all my knowledge base. So what does the happy medium look like to you?
Because we're the ones that bring it, I mean, you know, and we send it over to you guys. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I do think this won't pass. You said you're not creating a new protected class, but that's the first thing I wrote down. Because I think you are creating a new protected class. And whenever you get the, you know, the Civil Rights Division and involved, that's exactly what you're doing, in my opinion. And you said that an employer can fire somebody for their conduct, maybe not for their arrest, but for their conduct. But now onto this, the way I interpret it, somebody can get arrested, and the future employer sounds like almost has to hire them, and not based on the conduct of the arrest. You see what I'm saying? So you can fire somebody for their conduct, not because they're arrested, but not because of the charges not being filed, but you can base it on the conduct for that led up to the arrest. So to me, this sounds like the employer can't even do that. They have to hire them because they can't base it on, you know, just the mere fact that they're arrested and not convicted.
I mean, employers never have to hire anybody.
I agree.
Right.
But
the, it is just the record of the arrest itself that isn't a sufficient reason to deny somebody employment. You can deny somebody employment for any number of other reasons. If the hang-up is enforcement through your Civil Rights Division, as opposed to the substance of what would be being enforced. I mean, there are definitely other mechanisms of enforcement that one could look into, but you know, the enforcement mechanism before we moved the record sealing statutes was a criminal offense, which seems more onerous. Because if you look at the statutes governing how DORA is supposed to approach a civil rights complaint, and they're statutorily obligated to try to resolve the issue at the lowest level possible and to start the process when they get a complaint in of essentially saying to the employer, hey, stop doing that, and see if that resolves it. So, you know, having, and I can understand where you're coming from and where people may think that it doesn't play out that way, but I actually think having DORA enforce this type of thing is the less onerous prospect for an employer rather than facing some sort of criminal penalty or civil fine.
How about on, because we did pass the juvenile criminal Monroeville, that didn't pass. Why don't we have something similar to that? And I think one of the judges in Denver automatically seals records of juveniles once they've completed what they need to complete. Why don't we just have that as part of our process, that if you are arrested, but you're not convicted, that automatically the judges just seal that arrest record?
We have. It's not automatic.
Right.
There's maybe a process.
Maybe they should just automatically do it.
Well, we would like you guys to make it easier. The legislature has improved that system, right, Mark?
Correct.
Because now, in the old days, arrest, no charges, acquittal, deferred judgment, I would have to file a separate civil case, pay a docket fee, it had to be set for hearing, et cetera, et cetera. And the legislature, I think 2 years ago, passed a very good improvement to that, which says if I go into court and the case is dismissed, I can ask the judge that day with no docket fee, I pay basically a $65 processing fee, my client does, and the judge orders it sealed right then. Same with the successful deferred judgment. So the process has become more streamlined, less costly, and more efficient. But
you have to ask.
You have to ask for it. And you know, I just had a client who, you know, was not paying fees and didn't want to go to court, didn't want a lawyer, and I kept urging him, well, you show up and ask for this, you know, please. And he didn't do it because it wasn't automatic. So it's an interesting idea.
I think in some way those records, they're still going to show up on some criminal histories that employers pull. So just because it's sealed doesn't mean that some private criminal history company is going to comply with that district court order from Denver judge to take it off of their records. And when employer decides to run that criminal history with private background company, they may not understand what dismissed or sealed or deferred judgment, because there's also the arrest records, or however it's broken out, could be confusing still. So although a great idea, love that, doesn't actually solve the problem.
So then why don't you have a two-part to it? Number one, the first part is that upon dismissal of a case or completed, successfully completed deferred sentence, the judge will automatically, without having to be asked, automatically seal the record. And then number two, that there's a prohibition from revealing that information if it's been judicially sealed.
Because it's already out there.
Right. That's already there.
That's the problem.
This addresses a different problem, I think. This addresses it at the employer level. Because every time I seal a client's record, I warn them. I mean, I had this happen. A woman got arrested on a drug charge, no charges filed, sealed records. 8 years later, she's applying to be a teacher in the Department of Education. Says, what about her? And the CBI screwed up. They didn't get it sealed. So luckily, I still had all the records. And then, you know, but that took time and effort. And the Department of Education finally said, oh, okay, never mind. Sorry, Stan. It wasn't your fault.
And I think the ban the box concept came as a result, not necessarily of CBI, but the private background check companies.
There's
no regulation on them. And so what we saw happening, what we've seen happening over the years, is that the records may be sealed, CBI may even have the records sealed,
right,
but somehow the private employment background agency gets it, and they illegally turn it over, and then that's when the person is refused the job. So,
and that's why I'm saying maybe there should be a second part of it where there's a prohibition for any company to reveal any records that have been sealed judicially.
But we in Colorado can't control
other
businesses.
Yeah, but a California company does.
These are huge multinational.
No, we can control companies. If we say that you're doing business in the state of Colorado, we can certainly control that. You can't turn over X, Y, information to businesses within the state of Colorado.
And so then the question to that goes to then, who enforces that? Like,
there's still no enforcement
mechanism. Maybe there could be a private right of action instead of. So I'm just looking at the political realities. You're not getting enforcement action through civil rights. So maybe there could be a private right of action or a penalty or something. I would like to see this get across the finish line. And I'm just wondering, have my colleagues on the opposite end of the aisle feel good about it.
So is what I'm hearing that having the exact same substance, like no adverse action on the basis of arrest without conviction, sealed or expunged, but enforced through some other, some mechanism other than NORA?
Yeah, would be private right of action maybe, or penalties, or something to that effect, maybe.
Okay.
Would that make it feel better?
No, I'd have to see what I guess in running first, see how it would look.
Let me draft it up then.
All right. I'm not going to commit to that right now.
I think the problem is, especially when it comes to our clients, wait, you're not going to see the ability to do a private right of action. And so I think that's, there's lots of reasons why SOAR may or may not be a good idea, but to say the only remedy is a lawsuit, that's not going to happen with most of the beating clients. That may happen with loan clients.
But even then, it's, you know, so, you know, private litigation is so expensive. Access to courts is already an issue, so I would certainly want some other way. Because I didn't quite understand this, and maybe it's because I'm not up to date, but it used to be a misdemeanor for law enforcement, for example, to wrongfully disclose sealed records or anything.
Right.
And that's what didn't get moved when the statute got moved?
That
misdemeanor didn't get moved?
Right.
Okay.
And what we know is that EEOC, right, the federal equivalent of the SORA Civil Rights Division, does do this. It does have guidelines that say this is how we should run. So we're really just saying, okay, the federal government is saying this is how we should do it. Let's do it. We have the state agency equivalent. Let's add these guidelines to it.
Maybe FBI Director Southerners can handle this for us.
So then why don't you just go to the Civil Rights Division and put rulemaking powers into it?
Change the rules of the Civil Rights Division?
Yeah, they have rulemaking power. So just to follow along the lines of the EEOC guidelines, because the EEOC doesn't have this as a protected class, which Senator Cook is seeing, and instead they take a look at it as this is a disparate impact. And so they have their rules over it, so why wouldn't we go to Civil Rights and say develop those weapons consistent with the EEOC?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the Civil Rights Division has the ability to make a rule starting to enforce against something that's not in statute, but it's
Well, EEOC did it, it's not in statute there. That's race, color, national origin, religion, sex, disability, I think those are the main classes.
Right. But it is different in the sense that what EEOC brings is a disparate impact claim. So the harm as EEOC sees it is that you're disparately impacting people because of their race or religion or whatever. The harm as we see it is the actual act of saying, because you had this arrest out there, despite the fact that you were never charged and never went anywhere, we're not going to give you a job for that reason. And that is the unfairness that we're trying to address.
And you're also right, too, Civil Rights Division doesn't take disparate impact cases.
They don't take them?
They don't do the disparate impact cases. They take it to the EEOC.
Oh, interesting. And for what it's worth, I mean, if you look at the footnotes and the recommendation, this wouldn't put Colorado out on its own somewhere. There are certainly other states that have similar provisions to this, that I believe at least some of them are enforceable through their equivalent of your Civil Rights.
Which states?
Where's the footnote?
Republican states like Texas.
Is this California and New York, I see?
Yeah.
Don't jump to conclusions.
Mark, I would just point out to you guys on the as well that if you look at the Ledge Council Interim Committee, one of the recommendations in Representative Bliss and Reeves is the second chance. Considered the bill for a second.
Yeah, second, I'm sorry, which is not only talking, I think about, do we have the same emphasis today on crimes that we thought were super important 20 years ago, but also how it impacts the direct and collateral consequences of those convictions. So that may be something that you guys might want to make a presentation to with that internal committee, since there's six legislators there, maybe there's a little bit of work something out along those lines.
Yeah, you look into that. All right. Any other thoughts, discussion on the second recommendation? All right. So the third recommendation concerns state licensure employment. The state of Colorado currently either regulates the employment of or directly employs a substantial portion of the state's population. When somebody with a criminal record applies for either a state job or a state license, that their criminal history and the impact of it is regulated by Section 245101. That statute says that it's intended to expand employment opportunities for people who are ready to be law-abiding citizens, but it lacks some guidance in some important areas. First, the only clear statutory guidance that is provided for how criminal records are to be considered appears to apply only to direct employment by the state rather than licensure decisions, which is far more frequent. Second, guidance provided for employment decisions treats convictions that have been pardoned, expunged, or sealed in the same way that it treats all other convictions. Third, the provisions applicable to licensure decisions appear to apply only when the agency has to make a finding that the person is of good moral character, and that good moral character language is not actually used in most of the statutes governing individual professions. And finally, the statute only applies to discretionary disqualifications rather than mandatory sanctions. Now, what the working group learned through its conversations with DORA is that DORA actually doesn't have a widespread practice of denying licenses based on a person's past history. What we'll do, however, is frequently issue a conditional or probationary license to someone. And the result of that is that the individual's criminal history ends up going up on DORA's website as a part of their professional history, and DORA does not think that it has the authority to ever remove that from their website. So, this recommendation would do two things to 245101. First, it would make clear that the same standards govern an agency's evaluation of a criminal record, whether that evaluation is for purposes of licensure or employment. Second, it would indicate that for either licensure or employment decisions, an agency should not consider a conviction that has been pardoned, sealed, or expunged, or for which an order of collateral leave is issued specific to the credential or employment sought. All other convictions would be evaluated on the basis of the same four criteria that exist in the statute today. In addition to the two changes to 245101, the recommendation would empower DORA to issue conditional licenses on the basis of an applicant's criminal history. But then, if the individual remains free from any further conviction or licensing sanction, the individual could request that that conditional designation be removed, and DORA would have the ability to do that. DORA would also have the ability to leave the conditional designation in place if it was necessary to continue to do so. The recommendation would also refine the currently existing data collection requirement for DORA agencies so that we will know how many people are being denied licensure based on a criminal history and how many people are having their license revoked or suspended based on criminal conduct and how many conditional licenses are issued. And it would encourage the elimination of mandatory collateral sanctions by tweaking the report that all DORA agencies are already required to make during their sunset review process. They're already required to address whether any disqualifications that they impose serve public interest. This would also just ask that that same report address whether any mandatory sanctions can be converted to discretionary disqualifications. Right. Also recommends establishing an incentive program for private employers who contract with the state to use the same evaluation criteria for criminal records that 245101 requires the state to use. That would be modeled after a currently existing incentive program for environmentally preferable products, which is located in the statutes governing state source selection and contract formation. And the idea behind that was really kind of recognizing that I feel like we've seen two sessions in a row now that Colorado may not be ready to adopt ban the box as out of the world of private employers. So the thought became, what can we do to encourage rather than require employers to use those practices? And then finally, it includes a non-story statutory recommendation that DORA develop a written policy on how its agencies should implement 24-5-101 and make that policy available to the public on its website. Does anyone have any questions about that third recommendation?
Mark, this covers DORA. Did you look at or consider trying to make the Board of Law Examiners or lawyers subject to the same prohibitions of using sealed or pardoned convictions?
Well, that seemed just a little too self-serving to me.
Well, you have criminal
record. No, he tried and he said no.
No, it's, yeah, it's something I've represented several folks and it's always been very irritable to me that we have to disclose sealed. Well, we have to disclose arrest to the Board of Law Examiners.
Right.
If it didn't result in a conviction, including an unnamed client who had a curfew arrest in Jefferson Mountain Park, you know, when she was 16, she says.
Okay.
You go try and find those records 10 years later.
We did not consider that.
Okay.
But
I think it would be a heavy lift, but I'm not sure how you do it. But
well, I mean, the reality is this would apply to doctors and all sorts of people who are being, it's not as though lawyers are the only ones who work with people, so.
Okay.
All right, well that concludes the three recommendations that have been approved by the Management Task Force. We will almost certainly come back to the task force with recommendations about public housing, private housing. I would anticipate that both of those will very, very closely mirror the employment-related recommendations that you saw today. Criminal records information availability, something in support of pretrial diversion, and we may have something addressing child support debt as a result of incarceration, but yeah, all the...
I love your optimism,
Mark. Okay, so yeah, just cross that last list.
Question as it relates to that issue surrounding housing. So some of our law enforcement agencies do crime prevention stuff with apartment complexes, homeowners associations, and we talk to them about background checks, records checks on their tenants, and you know, the lower crime rate complexes is doing records checks and excluding people who might have certain criminal history backgrounds.
Right.
And even putting that in your leases. Thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, what I think that as to private housing, what we would be recommending is, I mean, just as what we're recommending for private employment is consistent with what EEOC is saying, what HUD is saying as to housing is much the same. That you shouldn't be keeping people out of housing, even private housing, on the basis of an arrest that didn't result in a conviction. And I believe that Colorado landlords are already prohibited from asking about sealed records, much as our employers. So, you know, all of the rationale for why people shouldn't be denied jobs on the basis of those types of records of things that, you know, either they never got into anywhere in the court system or a judge has already said that these should be sealed from public view. I think that those same arguments apply to housing as well.
Is there a thought from your defense counsel about the person who has convictions that's been arrested multiple times?
It's
and bringing them into your apartment complex, so single family as well.
Yeah, and that's, You know, that's a sticky question. I don't know how many, I don't know how many people who are out there who have been arrested a whole bunch of times and never managed to have a conviction on anything. To the extent that those people exist, you know, again, it's the record itself. It's pulling that background check, looking at the CBR report and saying, oh, this person was arrested for this crime, and using that information alone to assume that person did that crime. Now, I mean, if you look at the person, if you interview the person when they show up to look at the apartment and they look like someone who's going to be a problem, I mean, you know, yeah.
They look like ducks.
Yeah,
they're
an
easy little
person.
Well, some of the concerns that you're seeing, or that a landlord may see, are going to be reflected in other things that they're checking. Someone who's been in and out of jail but never had a conviction is still probably not going to have the best credit score or employment history, which are also things that are completely legal for a landlord to check into and say, I don't want to rent to you. So we're just saying, hey, if you were arrested and not convicted, we have a system that basically says, And so there's certain other legal factors, though, that certain employers and landlords are going to still consider and use their common sense and judgment and experience they have in that role and make decisions on who they rent to or who they employ.
All right.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much for your time this afternoon. If anybody either has more thoughts about what I presented today or wants to be a part of this stuff as we're working out the details, please reach out to me or any of the task force members.
And just to back it up even further in terms of looking at these issues, this commission indicated they wanted to look at reentry and what happens to individuals who are returning to communities. And the task force itself decided that this issue of collateral consequences was an absolutely critical issue associated with what is keeping people from being able to be employed or to find appropriate housing. Those are two critical issues associated with successful reentry. So these topics, while the methods or opportunities to bring about changes are certainly open to much discussion, I just remind you that these are the critical issues really associated with reentry that this task force has been trying to find appropriate recommendations for.
Very good.